Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Yale Law School professor Stephen L. Carter, author of Civility, Manners, Morals, and the Etiquette of Democracy, shares his thoughts on the issue of civility in politics in this lecture, which was originally delivered at Yale Law School on February 17, 2011.
When the Yale Law School Republicans and Democrats invited me, I had somehow formed the impression it was going to be 8 or 9 students around one of the seminar tables and me just having a conversation. So I didn't really prepare any remarks for a group this size, so I'm going to talk only very briefly in sort of answering the question asked, is civility important? And then also using my prerogative as a law professor to answer the question I think should have been asked instead. And then I'll be able to take questions and have some conversation about it. Since you've just been told that I wrote a book called Civility, Manners, Morals, and the Etiquette of Democracy, you might have the idea that when I think of civility, I think of manners and etiquette. But the reason the subtitle is The Etiquette of Democracy is the part of civility that interests me most has nothing to do with whether people are nice to each other, although I think being nice is important. It has to do, rather, with whether people are democratic to each other. That is, the question is, what is the etiquette of democracy? And that's really what I want to talk about. Because if you think about it, when we have these frenzied and anguished and ultimately, I think, silly public debates about civility and is it increasing or declining or is it good or it's bad, we're mainly talking about calling people names. That's what we really have in mind. And I'm not a great believer in calling people names, but that's actually a relatively tiny piece of a far more subtle and interesting problem. That's why when I talk about civility, when I try to argue that it is important to democracy in particular, I'm not thinking so much about whether we have the occasional insult or not. And insults can be very clever. One of my favorite insults, in fact, is when quite a famous one, when Disraeli was asked to explain the difference between a misfortune and a calamity. Some of you have heard this, I can tell by your smiles. He, referring to his political rival Gladstone, he said, if Gladstone fell into the river, that would be a misfortune. If anyone pulled him out, that would be a calamity. Now, I think that's clever. That shows someone's been inventive and put a lot of work into it. I'm serious. And so nowadays, people will say somehow there's something wrong with the rhetoric. I think that's quite splendid rhetoric, that you respect your opponent enough to be clever, come with something new to say, even if it's somewhat insulting. It's using the same old insults over and over again. It's the laziness that actually forms the problem. I'm quite serious about this. Because to me, civility is sacrifice. And in particular, civility represents the sum of all the sacrifices that one makes in a democracy for the sake of living a common life. That's what civility is, the sacrifice we have to make in order to live a common life. Civility defined this way is actually quite difficult to achieve. One reason it's hard to achieve, if you think about it, civility is not a dominant strategy for achieving anything. There is almost nothing, almost none of the many games we play day to day in life where civility actually aids us in a significant way in winning the game as an individual. But as a society, civility can be enormously important to democracy itself. Now, to explain what I mean by that, let me tell you what I mean by democracy. There's a tendency to equate too often in our minds democracy with voting. Those of you who have been my students, especially my students in election years, have heard me talk about how much I hate voting. I don't like voting. I have to be dragged to the polling place. I'd be happy if fewer people would vote. I've never understood the argument for trying to persuade people to vote who don't want to vote. Since people don't want to vote, you don't want them in the voting booth. And yet we always have this get out the vote campaigns, though it's important to persuade people to vote. No, it's not. It's better not to vote. You don't agree with me, that's good. Because as long as all of you think that's the nuttiest idea and you keep voting, there's no penalty on me for not voting. I can free ride on your voting, so that's great. Since my ballot won't make a difference, even the little town of Cheshire where I live, when we had the big battle over whether we should we should sell the swimming pool. I think it passed by 111 votes. You know, so my vote would have made no difference. 112, 110, there wouldn't have made any difference. So I don't believe in voting. I think it's a waste of my time, but it's not a waste of your time. You all go ahead and do it. That's the sacrifice you can make for the sake of living a common life. But to the point, democracy isn't the voting. In the last election before the American invasion of Iraq, Saddam Hussein got 100% of the vote. Not 86%, not 92.4%, 100%. Every single Iraqi, according to the government's figures, voted for Saddam Hussein. In fact, more votes were cast for Saddam Hussein than there were adults in Iraq at the time. They had an election. They voted. Most of us, what everyone thinks of the invasion, few of us would describe Iraq under Saddam as a democracy. So it's not the voting. It's what comes before the voting. Democracy, it seems to me, rests on the premise that we, all of us, are by the very by virtue of our citizenship, the right people to be running the country. We are the right people to make decisions, such as the important decision of who's going to represent us. What that suggests to me, then, is that there is actually a reason to vote, and the reason has to do with sacrifice. And I would put it this way. The reason we vote is to signal to other people that we are willing to lose. We don't vote in order to prevail. We vote to take the risk of losing. Every time we go to the polls to vote for our candidate, there's the possibility that our candidate will be defeated. And if our candidate is defeated, the other side's agenda will be advanced. By voting, we are saying to those who disagree with us, if you are willing to take the risk of your agenda suffering in this thing we call an election, I will take the same risk. I will lay my cherished convictions on that table. If you will, I will try to persuade people. If you will, that's the point. That's what elections are for. It's the willingness to lose, the willingness to have our agenda not advance. That's the signal. That's the sacrifice. The risk that we take with the vote is always defeat. In a democracy, it strikes me that the correct attitude to take toward that, therefore, is that we are all the co-equal citizens deserving of a degree of respect because of this grand effort that we engage in, the risk of defeat. And the kinds of incivility that tend to trouble people, all the nasty language, which has been with us since there's been the United States, of course. But a lot of that, I think, stems from a lack of fundamental acceptance of the proposition that I just stated, that we are out there to risk defeat. I'll put my convictions on the table if you'll put yours on the table, and in this we signal our mutual respect for each other. The mutual respect is too often, I think, what is lacking. We find ourselves, especially nowadays, one of the reasons I like this gathering here, we find ourselves more and more spending time with people who already agree with us. And this is true whether we talk about the friends we hang out with, the websites we read, the television programs we watch. We like to be agreed with. When we surround ourselves with people who agree with us, it is very easy to come to think that our views, whatever they are the natural, most reasonable ones because they're almost never challenged. And if we surround ourselves with people who agree with us, then the people on the other side begin to look stranger and stranger. They're aberrant. There's something wrong with them. And nowadays, because we're very lazy in our insults, the thing that's wrong with them is usually they are either stupid or evil. Those are the only things we can come up with, because the people on the other side aren't worth the energy of thinking about them seriously and insulting them cleverly. But it's not just an insult. It's a state of mind. It's a state of mind that reflects the notion that reasonable people all reach the same result. So if you don't reach this result, you're being unreasonable. You remember when Descartes said this, people thought he was nuts. They thought he was wrong because he was wrong. You remember some of you, do people still read Descartes at all? Nobody reads Descartes. Well, that's why, because he was nuts. But remember Descartes said, quite famously, remember Descartes says that, I think it's in his Meditations, but Descartes says that There's only one form of common sense. There's only one form of reason. And it always reaches the same result. And if people seem to disagree, he said, it's not because some of them have reasoned differently. It's because they're actually reasoning about different things. He said, they're reasoning about different things. But they can't possibly reason about the same thing and reach different results. Now, I just don't think that's true. I don't think it's true. But we behave as though it's true. We behave too often as though reason can only reach one result. My experience over the years suggests to me that one reason that so many issues are so divisive in this or any other democracy is because they're hard, not because they're easy. Some issues are divisive because there's a point on both sides. I'm not saying there's no issues that have only one side and people can't be horribly wrong. Of course there are issues that have only one right side. And all of us as thinking people ought to have in our mind two or three issues in which we can brook no possibility of being wrong. The problem nowadays, people have 17 or 28 issues on which they can brook no possibility of being wrong, and who disagrees with them is plainly either ignorant or stupid. And that's, I think, where the problem arises. So I want to suggest to you another possible way of looking at this. And to do so, I'm going to use a couple of tales of Thurgood Marshall, who you were told in the introduction I was law clerk for. I was law clerk for him in the 1980-81 term, and then in the last year of his life, basically 1992, I was helping him with his oral history. As you may know, all the Supreme Court justices, when they retire, are asked by the Federal Judicial Center to record an oral history, and they choose their interviewers. I was the interviewer for Justice Marshall's oral history, which meant that in the last year of his life, I probably spent 60 or 70 hours with him, of which we recorded 35 or 40 hours. Bearing in mind, we didn't finish his remarkable life by any means. In fact, he got sick, and therefore he had to stop, and then he died. But he got sick just about the time we got to the Supreme Court years. So we didn't do anything on the Supreme Court years. It was all the years before that, which is by far the more interesting part of his life, I think, those earlier years. There's a tendency nowadays when people say, oh, yeah, Justice Marshall, he was so great. All they really think about is, I like the votes that he cast. It's not really so much greatness as, well, he thinks like I do. Therefore, he's clearly a good guy. But his greatness, I think, was achieved in the years before he was a Supreme Court justice. In fact, I would suggest that of those who served in the Supreme Court in the 20th century, he was the only one, or possibly one of two, the other being Brandeis, who, if there were a legal hall of fame, would be in the legal hall of fame even if he'd never been on the Supreme Court. Marshall, as some of you may know, before he was on the court and before he was Solicitor General, he'd spent two decades litigating civil rights cases and criminal cases across the country, often for little or no pay, often at literally great risk to his own life. He would tell stories, you can find them in the oral history, literally of having to change cars in the middle of the night to escape a lynch mob led by the local sheriff, that sort of thing. It was not an uncommon experience for civil rights lawyers of that time. So when I first got to know Justice Marshall in 1980 and then later in the early 90s, I would ask him about these experiences. He would talk about them. And I remember the first time I ever asked him about these things when I was one of his law clerks. I was 25, 26 years old, and therefore, by definition, knew pretty much everything there is to know. I remember asking him about some of the great segregationists of the age. We weren't so much talking at that time about politicians. We were talking about lawyers and judges. And what surprised me at the time, and in certain ways, I think it's fair to say dismayed me at the time when I was in my 20s, was the genuine affection with which he would talk about people who were on the wrong side of history on this issue. When we got around to the oral history in 1991-92, he expanded on this some, and indeed I heard him speak with genuine affection about some of the great segregationist politicians in history. And when I say affection, I mean that there are people he actually liked. People used to tell stories about these people would give these vicious segregationist speeches, and then he would say, we'd go in the back room and he said we'd play cards and drink whiskey and make a deal. The deal part was important to him. He was interested in getting things done. He used to say, I don't care what a man has to say, get elected as long as his word is good. He had little patience with people who drew satisfaction from calling people names. He thought satisfaction would come from accomplishing goals. And the way one accomplished goals when there were people on the other side was to actually negotiate with them, which was quite difficult to do if you were running around calling them terrible names all the time. And you'd say this again and again and again. And toward the end of his life, he would talk about what he thought had gone wrong, or what he thought was wrong, I should say, in our politics, and some was exactly that. And we're talking about now, the almost 20 years ago, but it was a replay of what we're seeing now, or perhaps an earlier version of it. He would talk about the way that politics seemed to have regressed rather than progressed since his era of the 40s and 50s and early 60s of being politically active. And one of the things he kept pointing out, because he believed it, he kept saying that you could be wrong about this crucial moral issue of segregation without being thereby a wicked person. He would say wonderfully nice things, and apparently mean them, about lots and lots of people who were dead wrong on that issue. He said the fact that they're mistaken, he used to say, doesn't make them any less human. So I told you that story to tell you this one. A few years ago, well, actually, it's more than a few years ago. It's the mid-90s now, I guess. It feels like a few years to me, to you. You were in elementary school or junior high school or something. They don't have junior high schools anymore, middle school, whatever they do. I had lunch with a very senior Democrat who was retiring. It's not a more than story as Democrat. He just has been Republican and happened to have been a Democrat. He was retiring, and he was retiring in great despair. He was talking about how when he first came to Washington in the 50s or the early 60s, I think it's the early 60s, he said, you know, in those days, he said, we would stand up on the floor of the House and say these incredibly mean things about each other's views, and then we'd go out and get a drink together, and that weekend we'd go play golf, or our families would get together and do this or that, and we'd have a grand old time. And he said, people don't do that anymore. He's saying in the 90s, it's actually true even more today. He said, for this crowd, this new crowd, that's what you call them, this new crowd, it's different. He said, for them, it's personal. He said, for them, and when we asked him why, it was a bunch of us at lunch, when we asked him why, he said he thought it was because they thought they had nothing in common. And he reminded us of something you see in a lot of the work on civility. He said, you know, his generation, when he'd come along, they'd been through the Great War together, World War II, they'd been through the Depression together, they'd been through eras when there was a commonality of sacrifice that reminded them of what they had in common. He said, young people today, and when he said young people, was talking about young politicians, have had so much luxury all their lives that they genuinely think they have nothing in common with those who disagree because they've never had to do anything hard together. Everything has been handed to them. Now, it doesn't matter if you really think everything's been handed to any particular generation or not. His point about the lack of a sense of commonality is still, I think, quite well taken. And it's not an easy thing to overcome. But it's an important thing to overcome if democracy really means that we ought to be in dialogue with each other. I told you the most important thing about democracy is what comes before the election. Before the election, in the ideal vision, you know, some of you have heard Bruce Ackerman talk about deliberation day or these various other structural notions and also some more inchoate notions about how somehow we need to get out there and dispute with each other. One of the problems we have when we go out there to dispute with each other, aside from the fact that all our models are taken from these really wretched talk shows, and I say that although I sometimes have to go on these talk shows to try to sell books, but nevertheless, a lot of them are wretched. It's true, a lot of them are. And a lot of these, there's some very wretched websites out there too, some of which have said very nice things about some of my work, but they're still quite wretched in a lot of ways. When I say wretched, I mean that in a particular sense, that they present terribly damaging models of dialogue and how dialogue is to be carried on. It strikes me that the two crucial aspects of democratic dialogue, that's a dialogue that proceeds from the notion that we are all in this together, we're making sacrifices for each other, and one of the sacrifices is our willingness to lose. There are two crucial aspects of that democratic dialogue. One aspect of it is to always recognize that our own convictions, no matter how solidly held, are also contingent, because we can never have all the information. And so it is possible, even if you think it is unlikely, it is possible the other guy's got a point. And therefore, we have to be willing to enter into dialogue in a way that allows us to see that point in case it's there. And the only way that we can do that is to enter the dialogue in a way that's actually patient and open to the possibility of persuasion. We spend so much time in America, whether we are so trained or not, acting like lawyers. We act like lawyers. What I mean by that, lawyers are people who fundamentally, except for transactional lawyers, listen with their mouths. That is to say that the only point of listening is to make sure you've got the flaws in the other guy's argument so you can immediately point them out. And that's what we do politics in America. That's actually not a good thing, because if we only listen with our mouths, we never take time to think. If we don't take time to think, we can never reach reasoned conclusions. Bertrand Russell, in a wonderful essay that should be required reading for every student, you should read it when you're young, it's quite important, called In Praise of Idleness, Bertrand Russell says it's important to take time every day to do nothing. And when he says nothing, he doesn't mean being online or watching TV, even listening to music. To go somewhere where there's no influences around you and let your mind wander. So if your mind never wanders, if you're never away from the influences of the world, you can never make up your own mind. You will spend your entire life with other people making up your mind for you. You'll have no ideas of your own. You'll have only other people's ideas. Now, plainly, in our busy lives, it's unreasonable to think of wandering in that strong sense every day. But that doesn't mean we can't spend time wandering at all. It's that wandering, including wandering through our own minds and rummaging in the end through the minds of others, that helps us with the possibility of entering a democratic dialogue where we think we may be wrong and the other guy might be right. Related to this is, if you ever go into Grove Street Cemetery, you should find the tombstone of Kingman Brewster, who was, among other things, president of the university and ambassador of the Court of St. James's. And if you look at Brewster's tombstone, what's carved there, I was trying to find before I ran down here the exact quote. I can't find the quote, so I'm going to paraphrase it. He used to teach criminal law at this law school, among other subjects. And he wrote in one of his works, he said, the presumption of innocence is not just a legal presumption. He says it rests on an openness that believes the best and not the worst of the stranger. The best and not the worst of the stranger. If you saw or heard about President Obama's interview before the Super Bowl with Bill O'Reilly, there's quite a striking line in there when O'Reilly asked him about people who hated him. And Obama made the point, I think correctly, that he said, you know, my predecessor was hated, his predecessor was hated, and so on and so on. But then he drew a commonality. Remember, he said, people who hate me don't know me. And I think there's actually a lot of that. That actually captures a lot of social science research, that it is much easier to make broad categorical statements, strongly negative ones, about people we don't know. So the other point about getting to about a dialogue that gets us to know other people is that it improves our opinion of them simply by virtue of the fact that we've sat down and spoken to them. Now, I know that takes time. That's why I call it a sacrifice. But I think it's quite important to do that if we're going to call ourselves Democrats. Here I mean Democrats with a small D. And in fact, I hear all the time people saying when I say this, yes, but you don't understand, the issues are so, so important. But I deny entirely that the issues that divide us today are more important than the issues that, say, Thurgood Marshall was fighting over. I just think that's not true. I think it's not a supportable claim. But even if it is a supportable claim, even if they're as important, I would deny entirely that they are more important or more divisive than those issues, the scar of race for hundreds of years across America, was and in some ways continues to be. So if he could do it, I figure we can do it. And if we can't do it, if we in this room, I mean, you're the ruling class. You might not like that, but it's true. You might pretend that you don't believe in meritocracy, but you do. That's why you're at Yale Law School. You're going to be running the world. You're going to be running the world one day, and you've got to remember that. And so the question of how you conceptualize people who disagree with you is a crucial question for you to think about in your careers, whatever you may be doing. So if you think you don't have time or you think the issues are too vital to try to take the time to get to know people who have a different view and therefore promote genuine democratic dialogue, if you can't do it with all of your luxury, then nobody is going to be able to do it. In that respect, I want to close with a story that I first heard from my pastor although others may have heard it in different ways. In fact, I've since discovered that, although not a few rabbis have used the story as well, the story is about tithing. The story is about tithing. And in the story, as my pastor told it, there was a fellow named Joe, who used to be a hard-working, working-class fellow making a moderate income, and he would tithe regularly. He'd have 10% of his income to the church week after week after week. And after a while, because of Joe's hard work and talent, he began to rise in the world. He was making more and more money, and he kept giving 10% of his income to the church week after week after week. And finally, Joe became a millionaire, and then a multimillionaire. And although he was still very generous to the church, he was no longer giving anything near 10% of his income to the church, although he was still their most generous donor. So one day the pastor went and visited Joe, and he sat down, and he said, Joe, is there some problem? Have we done something to displease you? What's going on? And Joe said, oh, pastor, he said, you know, I'm really so sorry. So when I was writing those small checks, they were easy to write. They were easy to write. But as my income got bigger, it's hard to write those big checks. And pastor, please pray with me that I'll be able to tithe again. And the pastor said, put his hand on his head and said, please, Lord, reduce this man's income to where he feels he can tithe once more. And that's, I think, the story. That's the story of civility. I'll stop there and take whatever questions or comments you might have.